Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, The Mina Kimes Show, featuring Lenny. Mina talks all things football with her unique brand of humor and insight. Her friends join each episode to talk about the NFL's latest storylines, along with her football-loving dog, Lenny, making frequent contributions. Download and subscribe to The Mina Kimes Show and The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Also, Stephen A. Smith goes beyond the headlines to unlock a unique world of hot takes, one-of-a-kind segments, and can't-miss interviews. Stream all this and more on his new show, Stephen A.'s World, exclusively on ESPN+. Sign up now at ESPNplus.com. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we'll get you guys ready for the Super Bowl. We'll also talk about John Chaney and the Brooklyn Nets. But first, all right, Gabe, Matthew Stafford got traded to the Los Angeles Rams. Jared Goff headed over to Detroit, along with a couple of picks, first round picks. This trade has happened. Now, this is interesting because didn't we talk about the Lions last week? I ain't never think I talk as much about the Lions as I have in the last couple weeks. And I've gotten into like all kinds of arguments with Lions fans about Matthew Stafford because out of nowhere, they love him, right? Like, I used to always make this point about Stafford, which was he is the least scrutinized number one overall pick that there has ever been. And a comparison that I used to make was one to Cam Newton, right? Cam went to an SEC school, right? Cam was the number one overall pick. And there was just always this level of scrutiny on Newton that you never, ever saw on Matt Stafford. But it even went beyond, like, I think you obviously see the race parallel there. But, like, Matt Stafford was the king of the backwards baseball caps. You ain't never hear Colin Cowherd get on him about that, right? Like, somehow, a dude who was projected to be the number one pick when he was a junior in high school has always been pretty good, but not quite that, right? To put this in line with things that maybe we'll talk about later on the show, but have come up, bit of an overvalued stock, right? People have consistently bet on the potential of what Matt Stafford could be, but he never got to what I think people thought that he could be, but somehow people were okay with that. And we're never okay with that, right? Like, as a general rule, that is not what we do. And so what I found recently, I guess it's particularly with the Matt Patricia era, Stafford became a bit of a sympathetic figure for people because basically the idea was, look what the Lions did to him. Except, dude, I've watched the Lions. All of us at least watch the Lions once a year because they make us watch them on Thanksgiving. But also, like, I do my job, right? Like, I watch a lot of games from a lot of teams. And you know what it looks like when there's a quarterback that's just so much better than everything that's around him. And it never looks like that with Stafford, right? He never, ever seems to be like this guy whose talent is rising above everything else that's going on. He's just not that guy. He's a pretty good quarterback. He is probably in like the top 10, 12 range, somewhere in there. And you know what can happen with a guy like that? He becomes available for trade and you can get 2 first-round picks for him, right? Like, guys like that are not easy to find. He just hasn't been that dude, right? And all this, oh, man, but he's so tough. I don't give a damn about that. Like, I'm not saying it's not impressive, but that doesn't, like, really contribute to the bottom line discussions that we typically have about football players and about quarterbacks specifically. Like, that's typically not the way that it goes. But he is pretty good, and he is better than Jared Goff, right? Rams might have the best defense in the NFL this year. So on one side, you get the best defense in the NFL. On the other side, you got a pretty good quarterback who is capable of doing excellent things. You can win a Super Bowl like that, right? Now, if the Rams were to go win a Super Bowl, that to me would not be a confirmation of like the greatness of Matthew Stafford. If you just put him with the right thing. Well, if the right thing's the best defense in the damn league, then I think there's a lot of guys. Trent Dilfer won a Super Bowl once with the best defense in the league. We're going to have a lot of fun when this year comes around with Stafford because it's going to wind up one way or another being a measure of confirmation bias for people, right? That's what it's going to be with him. I just can't think of anybody with a career quite like him. Like when he was at Georgia, he was never the best quarterback in the SEC. Now, granted, he's played his entire NFL career in the same division as Aaron Rodgers, but he's never been the best quarterback in that division. You could make an argument that in the division that he's going into, he's the third best quarterback. I don't think anybody thinks he's better than Russell Wilson. And I don't know how much y'all watch Kyler Murray, but I do, and I'm telling you, man, that dude is cold. Like, next year, it is entirely possible that Kyler Murray is a better quarterback than Matthew Stafford is. That could be the case. But that's why the Rams had to do it. Like, if you out here with Jared Goff and half the division's got a better quarterback than you and the other team, it could go either way. And nobody, well, Gabe, some of y'all think that Garoppolo guy is good, but come on now. You know what I'm saying? Hey, man, you got to make that move when that time comes. Poor Jared Goff. Jared Goff got traded to Detroit, and he got on the phone with him. He was like, I just feel good knowing that I'm going somewhere where I'm wanted. They don't want you, dog. Rams had to send another first-round pick in order to put it in your pocket to make you not a liability in the trade. You got Brock Osweiler'd. Remember that? When Houston traded Osweiler to Cleveland, and they're like, we will give you a second-round pick. Just take him.
This is going to be such a culture shock for Goff, too. And we're really going to get to see how he performs in a different environment, because he grew up in the Bay Area,
yeah,
went to Cal, then went straight to the Rams.
And now he's going to Detroit. Welcome to winter, young man. A little something called the Hawk. It is on the way. But his career is so interesting, though, because he was one of the worst rookie quarterbacks we have ever seen. Then McVay got there, and McVay figured something out with him. And for a couple of years, they made it roll. And then the next year, they gave him all that money. And I'm convinced they gave him all that money the next year because they kind of felt like they had to, right? It just seems like the kind of thing that you do. And he had played well enough that you couldn't feel just confident that you could get another one of those. Keep it in mind that they had already traded two number one picks to move up to draft him in the first place, right? Because the Rams don't do first round picks anymore, as you may have seen in all of this. But they did all of that with Goff, and I have to give the Rams credit. Most people won't do this. They looked at it and was like, nah, we was wrong. Sorry about that. Got to keep it moving. We were willing to start John Walford over this dude when he was able to play. Nah, it's a wrap.
Who's in that draft with Jared Goff? Who are the other QBs?
Well, Carson Wentz was number two, but the best quarterback in that draft has clearly proven to be Dak Prescott, because the three first round picks that year were Goff, Wentz, and Paxton Lynch, who's out of the league. Out of the league. Right, but Dak turned out to be the guy in that draft. But, I mean, none of us thought that that was going to happen, to be fair. None of us did. Like, I can't blame anybody, really, on the you did not take Dak Prescott when you had the opportunity. Like, I can't sincerely play that game. Gabe, you remember Christian Hackenberg? I forgot about him. He went in the second round of that draft.
I mean, going into that draft, there wasn't the talk about how, it's a quarterback-heavy draft.
Yo, listen to who else. Jacoby Brissett, he's still in the league. Cody Kessler, I imagine he's somewhere. Connor Cook, forgot about that guy. Oh, I bet Dak Prescott was furious watching the draft, seeing these names go off the board. Dak didn't go until they got to the compensatory picks. The quarterback taken after Dak Prescott was Cardale Jones. If they had taken Cardale Jones before Dak Prescott, he would have lost his ever-loving mind. It'd have been a whole Dak Prescott that we didn't even know existed.
It's just interesting because you were talking about Stafford as an overvalued stock, and then juxtapose that with the man who's traded for, Jared Goff.
Yeah.
Did they sell Goff at the worst possible moment?
No, because they got Stafford. Like, they figured out how to make this work. Like, one thing about it is we talk about first-round picks in this trade, and obviously there were first-round picks, but there's a discounting that you have to do when you start evaluating these future picks. So if you want a second round pick, like if you're in the draft and you want a second round pick in the current draft, you're going to have to give up a first round pick in the next draft, right? So that 2022 first round pick is really kind of valued like a second round pick. And then you discount it again down the line, you know, as it goes. Like, it is a first round pick for like when it comes around, but there's something to be said for getting what you want right now. And the Rams have a quarterback that make them, I believe, a legitimate Super Bowl contender. Even if I don't think he's great. Like, that's the thing we got to get out of. Your quarterback does not have to be great for you to win a Super Bowl. Your quarterback is not great just because you win a Super Bowl with him. Like, Tom Brady is macro level great. he hasn't been necessarily great in like the last couple, 3 years or whatever it is, right? Like when they won that Super Bowl against the Rams. Nobody was really offensively great in that game, but Tom Brady wasn't like great that year. I would not argue. He is great. You know what I mean? But you don't have to have a current time great quarterback in order to get this done. The Rams out here, like, we done guessing. We done going out here picking these kids, crossing our fingers, hoping they work out. These are their last four first-round draft picks. Greg Robinson, who was the number two pick in the draft, an offensive tackle who turned out to be a bust. Aaron Donald in the same draft. Todd Gurley the next year. That pick worked out. They rode him to a Super Bowl, and then the next pick was Jared Goff. They have been scared to use first-round picks ever since. And now they don't have a first-round pick until 2024. They go a bird in the hand, and I get it, right? Now, granted, the thing is, draft picks, you can get them and you can pay them cheap, right? Salary cap and all of this stuff. But if you have two first-round picks in successive years, how likely is it that you're going to get a player as good as Jalen Ramsey?
Not picking where they are.
Right. It's probably not going to happen. So we got a Jalen Ramsey right in front of us, and we got these two lottery tickets. Nope, give me Jalen Ramsey. Like, I find this to be fascinating. Like, people talk about it as though they're mortgaging the future. Kinda, right? But those first-round picks cost money, too. And if things go well, you're paying for the privilege to ultimately pay them a bunch of money. You know? So they're like, look, what we got to do is we got to, like, get these Cooper Cups in here, right? Like, we got to nail these second and third round picks. Because that pick that they traded in order to move up to get Goff, it wound up being the number five pick in the draft that they sent to the Titans. You know who the Titans took with that? Corey Davis, a pretty good wide receiver. Now, granted, there were other wide receivers that could have been taken in their draft, you know, all, but that's what, it was a pretty good wide receiver. That's what they got out of it. Like, the draft has been sold to the people as this event, and people really get into it. And basically for them, it's kind of like, it's like day trading, right? Like, you go look and check out all these different factors and like, oh, I think I'm in on something, you know, like people enjoy doing that. But as I think about it, it's got to be like wild stressful for these guys whose jobs are hinging on betting on how a 21-year-old is going to turn out. Here's the other thing I think we need to consider when we talk about first round picks. I mean, it seems obvious, but it's something, it's in line with something that happens in recruiting, which is, so if you're a 5-star recruit in football or in basketball, that means you're around one of the top 30 players in your class. The gap between player one and player five is a different animal than the gap between player five and player 10 is a different animal than the gap between 10 and 15, right? So like with football, for example, I would say that the difference between the 15th pick in the draft and the 35th pick in the draft is probably not as great as the difference between the number one pick in the draft and the number 10 pick in the draft. You know what I mean? Like a first round pick, it kind of depends on where it lands. It also depends on who the people are that are going to be doing the selecting with the pick, if they actually have any idea what in the hell they're doing. All those picks that Washington gave up for Robert Griffin, go look at what the Rams got out of it. Like, go see who the players were. A lot of it, not really that memorable. The Falcons traded a bunch of picks to get Julio Jones from the Browns. Those picks turned out to be Greg Little and Brandon Whedon. Like, I think there's a couple other names that were thrown in there, but that was really the focus of it. You know, and the Rams are just like, nah, we're not. I see something that works right now. We're going to go ahead and get it. And people are like, oh, I don't know if this plan is going to work. They've been to a Super Bowl. They won a playoff game this year. And they made themselves maybe the best team in their division next year. There's something to this. There's absolutely something to this idea. Also, back to Stafford on it. I feel like there's no better, like, in his own team, in his own building, in his own facility, like Jared Goff may have been going through some hell. But it feels like you could just live in L.A. and not be that big a deal as being the underperforming quarterback. It don't really matter what Matthew Stafford going to do. He just going to go out there, kick it. Like, this is such a giant win for him. Calvin Johnson, mad as hell. Calvin Johnson retired because it hurt too much to keep playing football, and they fought him over $2 million on a signing bonus. Matthew Stafford said he wants to be traded, and they say, we'll try to get you where you want to go.
Anywhere but New England, right?
Anyway, yeah, he tried to go back. Look, if what he just dealt with the last 3 years was supposed to be based on New England, why would you want the real thing? And that dude's over there? Nah, I'm good on that, homie. I don't need that at all. And last thing, in case you guys did not know this, You're going to hear this a lot if you have not heard it already, okay? Matthew Stafford is from, well, he's from technically Highland Park, Texas, but he's from Dallas. He went to high school with Clayton Kershaw. Stafford was the catcher and Kershaw was the pitcher. Kershaw was the center on the football team and Stafford was the quarterback. Now, while I find it pretty amazing that either Matthew Stafford or Clayton Kershaw did not have the strongest throwing arm in the school, right? Like, that's a wild thing to consider that one of them did not have the best throwing arm in school. You're going to be so damn tired of hearing about that. It's going to be like when you watch college football and a team got a white quarterback and a white receiver and they always roommates and they bring it up every time he throws the ball to, well, I don't want to say always slow a foot, like Colt McCoy and Jordan Shipley were roommates and they were at Texas and Jordan Shipley was fast, but you know what I'm talking about. Like, it's always, it's like, yo, it's like the old days. Like, y'all set this up to, like, we could be roommates. You know what I'm saying? Like shuffle the deck up a little bit, damn it. All right, Gabe. Super Bowl. It is here. Patrick Mahomes. Tom Brady. Tampa Bay playing at their home stadium. Somebody has already been shot at a strip club. It is the Super Bowl. I feel like I'll be excited about this game once it starts. You know what I mean? Like, it should be a good game. I do find the matchup on some levels to be intriguing. But I don't know if the Super Bowl is ever, just because we're not in a monoculture anymore and there's so many different things for people to pay attention to and so much stuff that comes up along the way. Like, for example, we're in the week of the Super Bowl and the first thing we talked about on this podcast was the trade involving the Detroit Lions. We have so much more that is going on that I don't know if it's possible for the Super Bowl to hold on to us for a full week the way that it used to. Like, you really did just kind of sit up and anticipate the Super Bowl all the way through. Like, I found, like, doing talk radio, it really wasn't that much to talk about with the Super Bowl until Friday.
Is that different, though, this year? Because, you know, everybody's not all down there on Radio Row.
No, I feel like that's all, like, it's clearly existed and kept going, but I feel like a lot of that is declined in part because, like, with Radio Row, for example, there is a thing to Radio Row where everybody just shows up and you can get anybody on your show, right? Like, you can book all kinds of people who don't even know your name, whatever it is. You can just, like, snatch them and get them. I feel like getting those people's a lot easier now than it used to be. Right. Like, for producers and bookers and stuff like that, like the existence of social media. Like, one thing social media does is it already tells you which of these people already rock with you because they follow, you know, insert person here or whatever it is. And so, like, I feel like the lure of Radio Row just isn't quite what it used to be. Like, I just feel like when we had fewer things in that way, the Super Bowl was just all encompassing. Like, it's going to be like the highest rated TV show of the year. Like, I'm not making the argument that people don't care, but as something that we drag out the entire week, it's a lot harder to pull that off now. Like Media Day, for example, because of social media, Media Day for a lot of these cats was their one opportunity to get famous. Man, all kinds of people out here getting fame. You know, it's so much easier to pull that off before you get there, that there is just a level of dominance for a stretch of time that I don't think the Super Bowl is going to have anymore. But it's still going to win Sunday. Like, it's still going to be the thing to do, because in the end, whether or not we watch the Super Bowl rarely has anything to do with the intensity of the buildup. We just watch the Super Bowl.
No Radio Row, but also no Super Bowl parties this year.
Yeah, that's the part that's kind of whack for, like, the corporate folks. Although I imagine somebody down there party. That thing, look, man, that event down there in Tampa. What pandemic?
I'm just talking about for the everyday folk. People have, you know, family, friends over.
How about this? The everyday folk. What made you think they ain't about to be having no Super Bowl parties?
Lots of people probably won't. I'm sure there will be plenty of people there too.
You're right. There will be some people who will not. But if you don't want to see no Super Bowl parties, I suggest you do not get on Instagram on Sunday, because it's not enough that the people got to have the damn parties and try to kill each other. It's that they got to tell everybody about it. I don't give a fuck about you clinking your glasses. I'm not toasting with you, dummies. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, you go see the Super Bowl parties, unfortunately. Is that going to be the next thing that gives us a spike? Look, man, my brother told me this story. Dude, we know. He owns some properties. Man, he said he had to go check out the property, and he get there, and he got his mask on, and the dude answered the door. Ain't had no mask on. And it's not enough that the dude doesn't have a mask on. He out here challenging my man's manhood, you know? He's like, oh, man, I think you scared. And he's like, I'm not scared. I'm just cautious. So my brother said he was talking to me. He told him, I told him I was just cautious. Then he took a pause and said, and tomorrow I'll be going to his wake. Please don't go to a Super Bowl party. Thanks. John Chaney, former head coach at Temple University, died this week at age 89. I have overwhelmingly positive things to say about John Chaney, but I will tell you my John Chaney story. John Chaney, National Association of Black Journalists, one year gave John Chaney his Pioneer Award, and he came and accepted the award. And one cool thing always about the Pioneer Award, especially with the Motorheads, is like the idea of coming into a room full of black journalists, like always lit them up. Like just the very idea, for particularly for people of that generation, like they were just so proud that we would even have that event, you know. So Chaney showed up and he got up there and started talking, and he talks as long as he wants to talk. He's one of these dudes. And I'll just never forget, somehow he was talking about a conversation that he had with John Thompson about Arthur Ashe. And he referred to Arthur Ashe as being persnooty, I believe was the word that he used. And he was not a fan of Arthur Ashe. And if you need a confirmation that he was not a fan of Arthur Ashe, what I will always remember John Chaney saying, he said he was talking to Thompson about Arthur Ashe. And John Thompson was trying to explain Arthur Ashe was a good dude, but he just did it in a different way. And John Chaney said, just as natural and easy as he could, he said, now I won't tell you what I said about Arthur because he's dead. And they just kept on going with whatever else it was he was talking about. I'm like, what do you think we're supposed to do with this, John Chaney? Like, he just dropped it and he just kept it moving. I've read a lot of, I think a gentleman's name was Mike Jensen. I may be incorrect on the first name, but the last name is Jensen. He writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He wrote an amazing column about what it was like for him to cover John Chaney. And, you know, we talked about this before. Me and Joel Addison had talked about this, how we messed around. We thought Temple was a black school because John Chaney was out there coaching in a short sleeve dress shirt and they was playing on his court with volleyball lines on it. But I did think that Temple, like for real, was like a basketball power. I mean, John Chaney got them to the Elite Eight 5 times. And because all I knew was Temple with John Chaney, I did not recognize like what a momentous feat it was to get a school like that to that place. Like the 1988 Temple team is the best team in the country. They lost in the Elite Eight, but still, I mean, like that dude could coach basketball. And I talked about this on Twitter. His matchup zone was the only zone that I ever could respect because it was like an in-your-chest zone situation. Like there was nothing cowardly about the way they were getting down and the way they were playing that zone, man. Like it was intense and it was ugly basketball, though. Like, I'm not going to pretend as though watching Temple was something that you really enjoyed, right? Like, it was a real war of attrition sort of situation in the way that Chaney coached those teams. But there was also John Chaney, you know? Like, people make a little too much of him running up on Cal at that press conference, and it is hilarious. I'll kill you. It is hysterical the way that he went, and Cal was so shook, and I can't be mad at Cal because I'd have been scared to death too. Like, what am I supposed to do in this moment? Eddie Jones coming in with a towel wrapped around him to try to stop John Chaney from doing something ridiculous when he ran up in there. But that should not be the thing with Chaney that people remember the most. Like, one thing I do also give Temple a measure of credit for is they let John Chaney run that program the way that he wanted, right? Like, he achieved the goals that they had. They were running a clean program. They were running a low-budget program, to be honest, and they were getting results from it. And he was recruiting the players that he wanted to recruit and serving goals for the larger society that he wanted to. It's very similar to what happened with Thompson. Like, in a lot of ways, now, granted, Georgetown, I think, is also, as a university, is a bigger brand name nationally than Temple, obviously. But in a lot of ways, the difference between John Thompson and John Chaney is that John Chaney never recruited Patrick Ewing, right? Like, that's why, like, Georgetown made those 3 Final Fours under John Thompson Jr. Chaney never had that player. Like, the closest he really got is he almost had Rasheed Wallace, and then Dean Smith came in at the end of the day and then wound up getting him. But that's what stops him from like being in the Final Four. And if he had, then he really is like his stature in things is like John Thompson's stature is. He just never had that team and that guy in order to push it over the top. But man, I talked about that zone. Like, you knew you was in for a day when you was over there playing against Temple. Like, that was gritty. They were grinding. They were all up on you in that way. And this got me to thinking, can you imagine how mad John Chaney would be if he coached the Brooklyn Nets? Have you watched the Nets play this year, Gabe? It looks like the All-Star game. Like Dominique said this on TV the other day. It looks like the All-Star game every game with them. The statistic has been trotted out many times. I'm going to tell the people now who have not seen it. Since the Nets got James Harden, they're putting up an offensive rating. So like points per 100 possessions. They're putting up an offensive rating that would be the best offensive rating in the history of the league. Since they got James Harden, they are putting up a defensive rating that would be the worst defensive rating in the history of the league. I have never seen anything like this before. Nobody can guard them. They can't guard anybody. They look like the old Denver Nuggets. You imagine if John Chaney had to try to talk to Kyrie Irving to convince him to play some defense? He'd be like, wait a minute, son. Did you just say to me that the world was flat? Did he just say that? That's where we start with this. I saw someone once that said that the Nets were drawing like 72,000 viewers per game, right? And because people in New York City don't care about the Nets, I'm not saying that as a judgment of them, but nobody like in New Jersey, like the Kyrie Irving types, like you grew up with them or whatever it is, but like in the city, it ain't nobody squad from the beginning. They're not like people in New York are not going to just start watching the Nets just because they got Kevin Durant. It's not that kind of situation. Like they're not in the thing like, so like when I lived in North Carolina, Carolina fans watch Duke games. Duke fans watch Carolina games. State fans watch Carolina games. Anyway, it don't go the other way. But you understand what I'm saying? Like, it's that kind of thing. Like, Louisville fans watch Kentucky games and so forth and so on. Knicks fans don't watch Nets games. That's just not what it is. But I was like, okay, I'm going to start watching the Nets, right? Like, there's always a basketball game on here. We got two teams. I'm going to start watching the Nets. Man, the Nets be filling it up. Kevin Durant has been so incredibly good this year. It's impossible to explain. And Joe Harris goes sneak around and make an all-star team, right? But they can't guard a soul. Think about this. In that game, the one where Russell Westbrook hit that shot, where Beal hit the shot, then Westbrook, you know, stole the ball, got to Westbrook, he hit the shot. Durant scored over 30. I think Jeff Green scored 30. Joe Harris scored 30. Kyrie was up in that zone. Jeff Green scored a bazillion points, and they lost to the Wizards.
They lost to the Wizards because they didn't have anybody that could guard Beal?
They didn't have anybody that could guard Gabe. They gave up 150 points.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I was just thinking about it with the way that the Nets are constructed. Has Harden played with another guard that is that poor of a defensive player?
Oh, that's a good question. And if he has, he certainly hasn't that much. And Harden's a better defensive player than Irving is. Now, Harden did not play in this game that with the Wizards. But like you talk about, what was it they couldn't guard Beal? Where Beal did score 37 points, but Russell Westbrook scored 41. Mo Wagner scored 17. Ish, he's still in the league. Smith scored 13. Let me tell you this too. That does not get talked about nearly enough with the Nets. They ain't got no depth. Some dude named Bruce Brown played 32 minutes at shooting guard. Did you know that? Are you familiar with him?
Sounds like another still in the league candidate.
Well, actually, he just got there. He's like 24. I did not know. R. Perry, Reggie Perry. We learned something about Reggie Perry. He is 20 years old. He was a second round pick in 2020. He got minutes in this game. Tyler Bumpy Johnson got some minutes. And Timothy Luwawu Cabarro got 17 minutes. Landry Shamet is getting 20 minutes. Like, they got three dudes, man. They got three dudes. They got Joe Harris, and I guess this is the year that Jeff Green puts it all together. But this is such a fascinating experiment. And now, like, who's going to teach him how to play defense? Mike D'Antoni? Steve Nash? What insight does Steve Nash have into playing defense?
Well, so who are the assistants for the Nets?
He did bring in somebody that was supposed to be the defensive coordinator. Let's go find out who that is right now. Long-ass wiki page. I can't get to the good stuff.
I feel bad for whoever this guy is.
All right, all right. So here we go, here we go. All right, so we got the coach staff. Jacques Vaughn, Mike D'Antoni, Ime Udoka, who was an assistant with the Spurs for a while, Royale Ivy. They got a lot of coaches. Who the hell is Jordan Ott? Ryan Forehand Kelly. I have never heard of him. Oh, Tiago Splitter. Wow. Yeah, I don't remember which one of them was supposed to be the defensive coordinator, Gabe, but I tell you this, he ain't coordinating no defense. DeAndre Jordan. Time's about up on that one. And they still got to bring him out there. Like, that was the thing when they traded Jared Allen. I think he's tall man, not big man, but he's not old man.
I mean, you said it earlier with the statistics, but is this like one of the worst defensive teams that you can ever remember?
Yes.
Because you start rattling it off. Like, even people talk about Joe Harris, you know, as being this like defensive guy. I don't know if he necessarily has the foot speed to keep up with those smaller guards. And do you trust Joe Harris against like a Jason Tatum in the playoffs?
Here's what I would say about their defense. I don't know if it's the worst defensive team that I've ever seen. I think that award goes to the Paul Westhead Denver Nuggets. Not even the Doug Moe ones, but the Westhead ones. But they are the worst defensive team that I can think of on a good team.
Yeah, and that's what I meant. Like a team that's supposed to be like an elite team.
No, I can't think of a team that has the ambitions that this team has that is terrible at defense. That has never happened before. Like, honestly, if they get out there and start running zone, I'd be like, yeah, I guess. Might as well.
Yeah, I saw a stat from Kirk Goldsberry, who was on the Hoop Collective with Brian Windhorst. He was saying that since 2002, a team hasn't won the finals that's been, like, higher than 10th or 11th in defense.
It's 11.
And Nets are, like, 25th.
And dropping, apparently. Like, why would it get better?
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, today's If You Haven't Heard, Difference Making Stories are brought to you by CarMax. Don't just buy a car, love your car with the new CarMax Love Your Car Guarantee.
All right, Bomani, this first story, it comes from business.
I'm Alex Kirshner, co-host of the podcast Split Zone Duo, and I've been covering the GameStop stock situation for Slate.com. You know GameStop, it's the store that you walked into to buy Madden 2004, the year Michael Vick was on the cover, and then you went back a year later to trade it in. It's been a tough few years for GameStop because people were already moving towards buying games online rather than in physical stores like GameStop's, and then the pandemic came around and made it even less likely that people would want to buy games in a brick-and-mortar location. A lot of fancy investors on Wall Street, including at least one famous hedge fund, looked at GameStop, which had posted massive losses over the last few years, and decided that its stock price was likely to go down. So they decided to short sell this stock. That means you pay a relatively small fee up front to borrow shares of the stock, you sell it at a higher price, you buy it back at a lower price, and if the price has gone down, then great for you, because you've just sold high and bought back low, and you get to pocket the difference. Last year, the stock was trading anywhere between $3 and around $17. A bunch of people on a Reddit, on a subreddit called Wall Street Bets, noticed that Wall Street was doing this, and they decided to basically ruin these investors' day. The subreddit Wall Street Bets has millions of users, and they decide basically in droves to buy up this stock, and when they do that, they drive the price up. So the stock, through these people buying it on apps like Robinhood and TD Ameritrade, goes up from, you know, $15, $20 to at one point nearly $500 last week, settles in the $200 to $300 range, and it's been on a roller coaster ever since. This means a massive loss for people who are betting that the stock would go down, like this hedge fund, which, by the way, is owned by a minority owner of the Charlotte Hornets. This hedge fund needs to call in some rescue help from other rich investors, including, of course, Steve Cohen, the owner of the New York Mets, because some of the sports ties in this story are just exactly what you would expect. The hedge fund eventually is pressured to buy out of its short position. This is a massive, massive loss, very embarrassing for them. They lose millions, if not billions of dollars, and it's a really tough break for them. Meanwhile, some of these folks on Reddit have made huge money. They've reported turning thousands of dollars in investments into many millions of dollars in some cases. There was so much trading in the stock that some of these trading apps eventually paused trading of them because they said it was becoming a liability for them, given how volatile the price was. But the stock price has stayed really high despite these restrictions, which tells us something. It's not just a bunch of people on their couches swiping along on Robinhood who are juicing the stock. The David versus Goliath story, Reddit versus hedge fund, it sounds really great, but it's probably not 100% of what's going on here. Wall Street clearly has taken the side in some places of GameStop as well. And just as embarrassing as this was for one hedge fund, a lot of rich people have taken GameStop stock and only gotten richer.
Yeah, I got to be honest. The thing that frustrated me about watching the GameStop story is people were really trying to pose this like it was some kind of goddamn populist revolution. Like, I looked at it and I was just like, there are no good guys in this. Like, I was like, there's nobody on any side that I want to root for. I'm certainly not rooting for the hedge fund guys, right? And look, I appreciate the people that figured out how to hit for a lick on this. Like, I'm not even mad at them for figuring out how to game this, because so much of this game is about like throwing out this information and then making a stock jump up. But for reasons that don't even necessarily have to do with whether or not the operation actually makes money, right? So GameStop now has a valuation that is not in line with like what the company actually is. But I can make the same exact argument for Tesla, which is something that a whole lot of people have brought up. Like, the stock price of Tesla is largely fiction. And what you found out in all of this, I think a lot of people found out, is that the Wiz is Richard Pryor. Like, a whole lot of this is fiction. It's just kind of sort of made up stuff. Now, there could be some far reaching consequences to this. Like, a lot of those hedge funds, I was told what they wound up having to do was they had to sell at disadvantageous prices on actual good stocks in order to make up for what, you know, came around on this other end. But I think, like, for the kids, they feel like this is their victory against the boomers and all of this stuff. And, you know, the way that's played, like, that's part of it. And some folks have made some bread off of it. I do have to ask this question, though. Who was the dumbass that bought GameStop at 500? Like this was one of those things I felt like if you didn't get in on it at the very beginning, you just needed to keep it moving and wait for the next one to come around, right? But like, you heard this thing was going and then it got up to $300-$500 and you were like, yeah, I'm still going to do it. Whatever happens to you is your own dumb fault. But what's also going to happen in this is, I think, like, these folks, they get on the Reddits and they talk about this again. They were trying to position this as being a populist revolution. Let mine not broke ass show up in your Reddit and find out what to get hip on fast and drop a boatload of cash on it. That will not be no populist revolution. That will be just me coming up, because that's the thing, man. All of this is different people in different ways trying to come up. But what happened was, them hedge fund dudes, they didn't know what to do. They was out here talking about these folks on the Reddit like they was black people. Like, they were getting their stimulus checks and just playing around with it. Like, I ain't never heard white folks talk about other white folks like they were black people, like I did seeing those super rich people and how mad they were at these regular people with apps that were buying stock, because they need to legitimize the idea that they have earned this money. They don't have to legitimize it to me, but we've seen this happen all the time. Gabe, when the people got mad at me for Arthur Smith, the son of the CEO of FedEx, where I said that it looks like his dad helped him get a couple jobs, right? But hey, he earned it. Like, that's one thing, especially with white folks. Black folks don't have time to be worried about whether or not we earn something. It's too damn hard to get it however you can, right? White folks have to go tell everybody that they earned it, that they actually deserve this, right? Like, this was ordained from wherever it came from. And so a lot of these guys with all this money and this investing, what's happened is it ain't that hard to do. That if you got a little time to go through some numbers and use some measure of common sense, this is a product that people are going to use, right? This is a market that is underserved. These people can do it. They're starting here. It doesn't really take a genius to figure out how to do that. And we know it doesn't, because these people on the Reddits ain't no damn geniuses. So these folks up top that have made all this money and have talked about this, and their whole status in society is based around the fact that they've made all this money, they are so offended by the idea that these regular interlopers could just show up and break the game, right? Because it exposes them as maybe, just maybe, not being that special.
What'd you think of them being able to cry enough to the point where apps like Robinhood, I think it was just Robinhood, basically shut down trading?
Well, it was some other apps. I think Robinhood didn't have the money to cover all these transactions that suddenly people were making. Like, I don't think that the man just dropped the hammer on them on that, right? But let's say that that did happen. The funniest thing about this was all the dorks on the internet who were surprised. Like, they somehow thought that they were going to come out here and figure out the game and hit these billionaires right in the pockets. And that the billionaires are just going to be like, oh, you got us fair and square. Hell no. Immediately it was like, how do we make sure that this never happens again? And so I do agree with a lot of the younger folks, especially with the blockchain and everything else. They are a step ahead on the technology. That don't matter if they decide they want to shut this down. Like, if that level of money decides they want it, they're going to get it. And that was part of what was funny to me, is that these kids, we got them. What they going to do now? Trust me, they're working on something. You might want to be prepared.
Yeah, I mean, people will have to check the stories on it, but part of the discussion, I feel like, in the aftermath of that was that one of these hedge funds has actually a significant holding in Robinhood.
Yeah. Who you think really runs this, man?
All right. This next story comes from Health.
My name is Stephanie Krikorian, and I write about the Hamptons for Vanity Fair Hive. This week, I took a look at the very unglamorous COVID-19 winter in the Hamptons. People who have decamped from the city to ride out the pandemic are so bored they have taken to trespassing at the ultra-exclusive Maidstone Club and posting from other people's private cabanas on Instagram with the hashtag trespassing. There's been a run on traditional pantry staples like caviar and truffles, and people who bought guns in March to protect their Clorox stockpile are now facing a major bullet shortage. Thousands of homeowners of cottages and eight-bedroom mansions alike had a rude awakening when they discovered their homes were on septic systems that needed to be cleaned. With unprecedented full-time home use, many are placing emergency calls for cleanup as they step through raw sewage that's leaked into the yard, basement, or backed up through their washers. And February 1st is the unofficial start of summer because the highly coveted, limited in number, East Hampton Village Beach Pass went on sale, but with a 25% price uptick from $400 to $500, which has many beachgoers beside themselves, though money being no object in the Hamptons, they will still sell out.
That explains why I've been seeing a lot more of my neighbors. Yeah, one of my neighbors, they made the Hamptons move, which it totally made sense, right? Like, I got it. I was a little jealous in some ways because I ain't got it like that. But they made that move out to the Hamptons. They put the kids in school, all that. But I had not considered that the Hamptons is not built for y'all to be here, especially right now. That's not what this is equipped for. That's hilarious. Like, imagine, like, the people just on the street fighting each other. Like, I went and visited with a buddy who had a place at the Hamptons, and he was talking about, like, the different people that he'd see just, like, walking around the neighborhood and stuff like that. Because, see, the thing, for especially, like, for the famous people, they go kick it in the Hamptons without security. Like, you just go walk around the block, like, you know, in ways that they can't in some of those other places. But what there is to do in the Hamptons, be in the Hamptons. It's cold now.
Isn't that really the absolute height of luxury? A place that just isn't built for people to be around there for that much?
This is total 1% problems. 1% of 1% problems.
Oh, my gosh. And to imagine people like that with their septic tanks coming out the back of their laundry machines and in their lawns.
Yes. And they're also eight, but so many like handymen. You know what I'm saying? Like, this place does not have solutions for problems of this magnitude. Like, I bet the mayor of, you know, because there's all the little towns out there, each of those mayors is like, yo, I did not sign up for this job. Like, there are real things to be done now.
Yeah, and I mean, it's your point about the handyman's, like, what's the maintenance that, you know, goes on around those parts? They shut off the electricity, they shut off the pipes for like half the year.
Right. There was a guy whose job it was just to come over every couple of weeks and warm your car up for you, you know?
Oh my gosh. All right, this last story comes from Music.
Hi, my name's Noah Yu, and I'm a staff writer at Pitchfork. When you start a new Spotify account, the first thing it asks you to do is to select some artists and genres that you enjoy in order to give its recommendation algorithm a better sense of what you want to listen to. A new patent granted to the company last month has given us a look at how Spotify imagines they could cut out the middleman, you, by simply listening through your microphone in order to better recommend music to you. The patent outlines the use of speech recognition tech to pick out different metadata points, like the listener's gender or accent or age or even emotional state. The patent also discusses how Spotify would be able to recognize the social environment of the user, like whether they're alone or with friends or at a party, and adjust its recommendations accordingly. Now, this is all pretty eyebrow-raising for several reasons. For example, how would an algorithm decide to react if it detected that a user was in emotional distress? But the patent doesn't actually get into exactly how this type of tech would be integrated into the Spotify app, and it should be noted that companies are constantly filing patents for new inventions, many of which never actually make it to market. This particular patent was originally filed in 2018, and it was only just approved this past month. So at least for the time being, there's no reason to suspect that Spotify might be listening in on you.
No, you just gave me reason to suspect that they're listening in on me. No. You can't do that and then be like, there's no reason. No. I wasn't suspecting that they were till you wrote that story, right? So, yes, I am going to suspect, Noah, that they are listening in on us. I mean, they might not be, but, anyway. This was my thing about this story. I don't, like, how Spotify know how it is that I handle bad moves? Because, Gabe, you know what I'm not about.
What is that?
You remember that? Not about that wallow.
No, yeah, I remember. Not about that wallow.
Not about that wallow. That's not what I do. So I might be over here. I might be a little bit sad. Don't be out here treating me like that. I'm not trying to listen to The Cure or what do they call them, The Smiths. I'm not trying to listen to Adele. I'm not, like, I don't, no, that's not, what's his name, Kid Cudi? I find that you somber people of a certain age, that's your bum out option. That's not really how I approach these kinds of things. Like, I don't know. Spotify, I feel like, is operating from the perspective that there is like a baseline sad person who is not like me. Like, and that's where I thought one point he made was interesting. It's like, so now that you know the mood, how exactly are you going to handle it? Are you going to try to make me feel better? Or are you going to try to make me feel worse? It could go either way.
I mean, it's basically like an AI robot. They're trying to cheer you up.
Or keeping you sad.
I hadn't thought about that, actually.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You don't strike me as being about that wallow. I don't get that vibe off of you. You seem a pretty level sort.
I'm just as varied as anyone else.
Yeah, but I don't think you're a wallower.
My wife has been known to tell me that my music can sound a little sad at times.
Right, but I mean, but as a man, you're not a wallower. I just don't see that. I just don't see that in you. I've not gotten that wallow vibe off of you, you know. But yeah, I don't really do a whole lot of sad music. I don't do a whole lot of happy music either. My music, yeah, there's a common theme.
Distinguish between not being about that wallow versus being interested in sad sounding music.
I think that one can have an appreciation for the minor chords and the like and the somberness that goes in that direction without necessarily relating to it personally at every turn, right? But if I am feeling sad, I don't need another sad person.
Totally fair distinction.
Yeah. Like I say, you don't strike me as a wallower, but I do feel like your wife just basically said you listen to a lot of Radiohead. Is that a fair guess?
I do listen to some Radiohead, yes.
Yeah, they're a bit of a bummer. It's not a fun listening experience, even if you like it.
There's a mood for everything, right? There's a mood for everything. There's work music. There's gym music. There's chilling around the house, doing some cooking music.
Yeah, and there's some people who listen to sad-ass music while they do all of those things.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. So, interesting topic. Describe the scene from whence the topic came from.
Yes, I don't know if y'all seen this, but this dude from Clemson, I don't know what he had on his mind. Jalen Johnson for Duke was on the fast break, and some dude for Clemson decided he wanted to be a hero. And he didn't even really make no real approach, but all he did was get yammed on, right? He just wound up with that hammer on the back of his neck. And I had some people on the internet and talking about it, trying to give him props for, you know, going all the way to the end of the play. And that is ridiculous. Now, I want you to listen to this tweet that this one dude sent me and tell me this ain't the biggest load of bullshit you've ever heard in your life. He said, I got to admit, the whole attitude of being dunked on is lost on me. When I was in high school, we played this team that dunked on us 18 times in a Christmas tournament. We won by 25 and the tournament. I appreciate the athleticism, but in the grand scheme of things, it's 2 points. And first of all, ain't no team that's dunking 18 times in a 32-minute game losing by no damn 25 points unless y'all was playing rock and jock. Number two, in the grand scheme of things, it is not 2 points. In the grand scheme of things, I got dunked on 18 times. But you were trying to minimize it to the bottom line. That is not the grand scheme, damn it. Dunking is fun. Getting dunked on is bad. And so I decided to ask the people about times that they either witnessed or bonus points for they themselves, you know, saw somebody who decided they wanted to be a hero and it did not work out well.
I mean, and what came off of it? was quite interesting because you have a range here. Getting dunked on, like the actual act of getting dunked on. But then there's getting dunked on like in life.
Ah, yeah.
And there's getting dunked on like in other sports. Like what would constitute getting dunked on in other sports? I mean, we've had some really important work done by yourself and by Roy Wood Jr. on this podcast.
Oh, yes. The stiff arm versus dunked on.
Hang it up in the Louvre. But some really, really good stuff here. Our first one, my man was in New Jersey, didn't leave his name, so I'm sure that was intentional. But here it is, the first one.
Hey, Bomani, I love the show, and it's my first time calling in because that prompt hit home and hit a little too hard. I played baseball my whole life, you know, for a variety of reasons. In high school, I didn't play much, but I did get in the game because of my quote-unquote hard work and effort late in a game against Millville High School, and I got in there late in the game against a young man named Mike Trout.
Oh.
And all that hard work and all that effort to get into the game, I threw one pitch, and I kid you not, I didn't even see the ball go by me. And it went so far in the other direction, and it just was the most disheartening thing ever. Years of hard work, got in just to play a little bit and to see the ball go so far in the other direction from a future MVP.
Yo, that sounded like they set him up. Like, fine, all right, you really want to pitch, right? You've been begging to pitch all this time? Fine, send him out there to pitch.
An interesting, like, someone who's, like, a hard worker, doesn't get that much playing time, comes in directly to pitch. Not necessarily, like, goes in, you know, throw him out in right field. There's not many balls. Go over there, like, hey, good for you, man. Like, you got a little bit of PT. Getting thrown in to pitch, that is, like, to the slaughter right there.
I would also like to note, though, sir, nobody said you had to throw him a strike. I wouldn't care if the bases were loaded. No one said you had to throw a strike.
All right, this next one comes from Ishwa, New York.
My story on working hard to get dunked on is a little different. I've been working in finance for the past 2 years, averaging like 80 to 90 hours per week. This past week had been particularly longer with the new deal we were working on. And after going the extra mile to make sure everything was wrapped up, I was told on Friday that I was being laid off. To make things worse, my predecessor who just joined gets to reap the rewards for the work done over the past 2 years. That's the first time I got dunked on, and it sucks.
Damn. Let me tell you what that was right there, Gabe. That was just a man who needed to talk. There is no reason for him to believe that what I requested in the prompt was actually like about this figurative dunking on about what's happening with you. I hope that everything is okay, because I did not expect that at all.
One, damn. But yes. Two, figuratively getting dunked on.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. It's a bad break. Yikes. Imagine working in an industry where you just know walking in, I can't trust a single person here, right? Because nobody's in it for noble reasons. Everybody's in it for self, right? There is no larger noble reason to want to do any of those things. Everybody's just in it for self.
And they're constantly dunking on people. Yes. Just like with what happened to GameStop. They feel like they're getting dunked on. Then they are dunking on the Wall Street guys.
Yes.
A lot of dunking doesn't always happen to happen in basketball, right?
That's right. Do we have an actual basketball story?
We have an actual basketball.
Okay, thank you.
There was a lot of good ones. I'm with you.
I was just going to be disappointed if we didn't. I wanted to hear about people getting dunked on.
All right, this last one comes from Eric in Cincinnati.
Ooh, where's this going?
I was in college at Ohio University in 2015. And saw a crowd at the basketball court outside my dorm. So me and some friends went outside to see who was playing, and it really didn't take too long to spot the 6'4 dude with dreads. Probably didn't go to college in Athens, Ohio. Everybody in that pickup game definitely wanted to be the one to lock down the rapper who was playing before the local concert in town. And shortly after we got there, a guy who, I swear, he could not have been more than about 5'8". He went up to try and block Waka Flocka Flame. Didn't end too well for him. But I guess he can tell his kids he got dunked on by Waka.
I was not expecting the turns that story took to end with someone being dunked on by Waka Flocka Flay. Oh, man. Look, rappers are notoriously not good at basketball. Like, you pick the wrong one if you get dunked on by a rapper. Damn. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. Gabe Bassett, Tariqa Foss, Christina Buswell handle things behind the scene. Thank you guys. Also, thanks you to our friends at CarMax. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Alex Kirshner, contributor at Slate. Check out his story on the whole GameStop thing. Thanks to Stephanie Krikorian of Vanity Fair. Check out her story on all the things going wrong on the Hamptons during pandemic. And thank you to Noah Yu of Pitchfork. Check out his story on Spotify, getting some weird patents over there. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.